Welcome back to Solid Ground. This is a little bit unusual in that we're just kind of a continuation of what we were talking about last time. There was not a particularly new topic, but if we run out of steam on the old topic, I do have one to bridge us until next time, which is when we start our three-part series on the Trinity, but I won't, because I'm sure we won't end up hitting that exactly at three. But we will start the doctrine of the Trinity next week. That'll be, I imagine, a very good energetic discussion, because I'm going to try to be a little bit provocative at the beginning of it, given a little bit of the teaser trailer will be this. I would say at least 80% of the time, if you ask a Christian, Catholic, or Orthodox, or Protestant to say, can you tell me a way to explain the Trinity, the way that people do it, almost all of them have already been classified as heretical by some church council beforehand. So we haven't done a great job in explaining it, and I think a lot of times when we are frustrated about sometimes understanding what the Trinity is, it's because we haven't done a terrific job in thinking through and educating everyone on what we really mean, or what real deal highfalutin theologians really mean when they talk about various aspects of the Trinity. So if you've ever found it confusing or you've been bothered by it, I encourage you to give it a shot and see what you think next time, next few times.
You know, we're good at explaining it when we can tell you what it isn't.
Yes, right. And as long as we got an infinite amount of time, we're going to be good at doing that. So it'll at least help us kind of, if you're willing to do the mental exercise of saying, all right, let's pretend I don't know anything about the Trinity. Let's just go pull scriptural references and see what they lead us to think, and then look at some of the earlier doctrines and see where they went, and we can talk in detail about building a coherent view. Yes, sir.
I can't believe I'm praising Scott, but he wrote a paper on this, and I have to admit, it's pretty good.
Well, Dennis is
not true, but it's pretty good.
Dennis, for those who don't know, Dennis is our resident atheist. Solid Ground is open to everybody of every persuasion, and Dennis is the bravest man in the room on multiple occasions, not only for that reason. Well, thank you. I appreciate it. And thanks, Dennis is helping critique it. And there's no critique like a maximally opposed critique. Okay. I'm doing a little bit of delay until, yes, okay, Skylar and family arrive. Oh, no, there will be carrying water for Skylar. All right, very well. Young man, you have an opportunity. As your old man is not here, you get to argue on his behalf. No, I'm just kidding. I'll pick up Skylar's position then on some of this. But we had left. Oh, there he is. All right. We had left last time with a point that I said that we ought to flesh out more between. That actually started. Skylar had started some of the discussion. Dennis had brought it up, and Kevin had an answer back, and I had punted till this time because it was too good and too long a discussion to be had in the last 120 seconds or whatever we didn't have left. So Dennis had brought up the point. We had laid out an idea of how, in the logical problem of evil, which almost all philosophers believe has been answered today, the probabilistic problem of evil, like if God is so amazing and so smart, how does all this bad stuff still happening? So we gave an answer last time. If you weren't here, it is on video. It's on our Facebook page. It's on our website. I can give you the links to it if you're interested in seeing it. Some of it will probably get rehashed a little bit here, but basically the point got down to, if you're going to build a world that has love and has free will in it, then you want, this was the other really key part, if you wanted to maximize the number of people that make it into heaven, utopia, into a loving relationship with God, etc., then you can't just take people as you make them and as their free will would choose, because some people will learn over time of having seen the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing that they don't want to do that, and they would rather come back and trust God. That is to say, something like Adam and Eve made the wrong choice in the garden, but as they got to see things and they got to see what evil was, did they turn around and say, you're right, Lord, we should have listened to you. In the future, we will do so, and made him Lord again. And if the answer is yes, then there's an example of two people that would not have otherwise come to God if they hadn't had the opportunity to experience and see evil. And so the argument we made last time was something like, there's a particular number that you would predict, some percentage, some fraction of people who will be like that. And God might be interested, in fact, kind of ought to be interested, we would say, in rescuing those people and not just the people that would say yes to him in the first place. So if that's the purpose of the world, then you would understand why the world would look like this. I think Skyler used the term arena phase. We're kind of in an arena phase of building towards utopia, and then new heaven and new earth or whatever would be that utopia, which now has the maximum number of people given how many people God would create. Okay, so that was a lot. I'm trying to put an hour's worth of discussion into two minutes. Thank you, sir. Now, Dennis made the point, though, coming from a position, if you come from an atheistic or agnostic position, you might say what Dennis said, which is, that's great, but what you said is you're basing your world, your justification of why this world would be that way, based on purpose. God's purpose for this world is, fill in the blank, maximizing the number of people that come to him, or maximizing his glory, or whatever your theological position leads you to believe, or whatever you deduce or infer. Purpose. In the same way that you can't say, is this a good car, or is this a good truck? It depends on its purpose. Ferrari is terrible for hauling dirt. Dump truck, terrible for going into corner one at, you know, maximum brake and traction. So you have to define purpose for something before you define whether it's good or not, whether it does well or doesn't do well. But Dennis says there is no purpose to this universe. This universe, quoting him, is it is what it is, and perhaps I would add to that, and it is no more. So if you, on the one hand, you say there is no purpose to the universe, then maybe nothing surprises you about the way this universe is. Kevin retorted, I think. In theory, not in practice. So, having put those two grenades out in the middle of the room and pulled their respective pens, I'll leave it back to y'all to pick up the discussion at that point of, is there, or Dennis can add to it, and we'll go from there. Go ahead, Dennis.
Well, I got another one. Original sin was whoever, Eve or Adam eating the apple, but it was that little scenario. That's what infected the rest of the human race.
Yes, I think, yep, right, that's the idea.
Were the damn children before she ate the apple?
No, not according to the recount.
Well, how do you know that?
Only if you take the account to be not exhaustive, but if it's supposed to have hit the high points, it doesn't actually. It says after the point that happened, there's a verse, I forget how many verses later, that says, and then Adam lay with his wife, and she gave birth to a son, and they named him.
And he didn't lay with her before she ate the apple.
If he did, there's no record of it. So maybe you could say we don't know for sure, but the first recorded one are the two sons that you see who come into conflict. Okay. Kevin, do you want to elaborate on what you meant?
Well, I think what Dennis was saying, that atheism has no converts, right? It just is, and it's true, and that nobody's really trying to convert. But I was reading...
You say no conflicts?
Converts.
Converts, okay.
Yeah. And I said, and that's when I said, in theory, but not in practice.
Ah, okay.
I mean, most every atheist I've ever met is trying to tell you why you're wrong. And myself included, right, in my atheism. So, who's the illusionist? I don't know, the famous atheist.
Oh, Penn Teller? Yes.
Yeah, Penn Teller. Yeah. Penn Teller actually said, and he quoted, he said that if atheism is true, that everybody must believe it, and he'll spend the rest of his life trying to convince people. So, you know, I mean, I think everybody is, in some level, trying to influence other people to see their point of view or perspective, and kind of a human nature thing. But
I agree.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was getting at. And then, to Skyler's point... We kind of disagreed on something. I think Skyler was right about it, about the ratio of evil becoming less. I was arguing that more people had died, and he was like, yeah, that's because there's more people. And I'm like, well, that's true. So, yeah.
Yeah, so that was an interesting point. If we don't want to jump off, I'll put a couple of them out there, and we can talk about it too. Skyler had made the point of basically this. The world is getting better. And the question was, is that the case? If that is the case, why is that the case? If it is the case and the reason why has something to do with some godly principle, then why don't Christians point to this and make some of the arguments about Christianity or Judeo-Christian ethic or whatever from that idea? So Schuyler, nobody actually, we didn't at this point cite any research or studies or whatever else, but basically the question was, in the whole world, is the whole world trending up? And we'll draw our graph here of here's time in this direction, and here's evil. So the amount of evil, is it doing this? Where there's going to be little spikes or whatever else. Is it trending downwards or is it doing the opposite? And Schuyler made the point that he believed that the numbers, the data suggested that evil is trending down over time. And I think you cited violent crime statistics as kind of an example of this. Counterexample was, last century was the most deadly century on record. Counter to the counter was it's also the most populous century on record, so it matters whether it's done in terms of percentile of the population, et cetera. And then I threw in there something as well to say, if here's the whole, we talked briefly about Noah. And what we said was Noah, the world with before Noah, right before the flood came, got to the point where it was, you would almost say, as bad as it could get. Maybe that's the way to put it. Because if you take the verse very literally that says, every inclination of man's heart was to evil. Like there wasn't even an angel and a devil on your shoulder. It was a devil and a devil on your shoulder. So which one are you going to do? And it said the world was filled with violence. So it also implies that when man gets to the point where they're not considering good, they're really choosing between two evils, or the good is so minimally influential that they're just doing wrong things all the time, that violence is the natural state of the social relationship. That there's no reason not to be violent, because if you see it and you want it, you can take it. Nothing stops you. So if that's as bad as, maybe that's not as bad as the world could get, but I would say sounds like a pretty good description of as bad as the world can get to me. If that's the way it is, and let's, this circle right here isn't the globe, but maybe it's areas of influence. Something like, this is not a rigorous number, but let's pretend for the sake of ease that half of the world comes from a Judeo-Christian, if not ethic, we'll say background, where those countries may not be living that way, but they have that in their background as kind of in addition to Roman law and Hammurabi's code and that kind of stuff, that it was there's been a Judeo-Christian influence on the legal traditions, on the structure of government, on that kind of stuff. And then the other side, and maybe you could put, you ought to put Islam in here, since Islam is in many ways kind of an offshoot of the two. On the other side, you might put, Hinduism, Buddhism. What's a good representation of Hinduism? Shintoism, any animistic religions, that type of thing.
I want to see you draw Buddha, because you're definitely getting better
at it. I haven't hit that level yet, so I won't embarrass myself or anger any Buddhists at that point. But let's say Buddhism, Hinduism, just because those comprise the large majority of the opposite side. But outside of there, and maybe I can put a wedge in here, because it actually comes out of each one of them. And this was not meant to be a peace symbol, so let me erase that other part. If I could have figured out how to work that into something terribly clever, I would have, but I'm short on creativity this morning. Out of each one of those traditions, there came an atheistic idea. I'm not going to blame all this on atheism, because we can do the same. But we'll say nationalistic atheism, or really you can put that in parentheses and say, communism or fascism or socialism. But these are intellectual ideas where they're not based on the idea of a higher power, a deity or a theological construct. But these are, I would say, humanistic systems of some sort. Now, the humanistic can also, there's humanistic considerations in all of them, and this is a vast oversimplification, so nobody criticize me on the political theory side of this. That's not my point. My point is to say something like, if you're going to make the counter to Schuyler's position and say, all this blood, death, and really the majority of that is happening in great swaths, Mao killing tens and tens and tens of millions of people, the Nazis exterminating millions of people, that kind of thing. That happens in, you know, maybe fell swoops, including the war, where people on either side are killed, and it wasn't necessarily a consequence of the outworkings of those things, but rather the conflicts that were brought on by them. But that this part of the world was certainly more violent. But that, so if you were going to graph this part, you might say that when we hit the 20th century, those nations were kind of doing this, and then there was this big uptick. And then, of course, the spike goes back down again. You consider communist China right now, they're not killing people by the millions anymore. I guess they're done with that, hopefully. But you see these spikes right here that kind of might throw your data off otherwise. But that in these two spots, then perhaps the trend line's going down. And the question is why? Go ahead, sorry. The question would be why? And so someone would have to, at this point, establish a causal link between this background, or I guess my first point back to Skylar is, isn't it the case that Buddhism and Hinduism relate also end up with a downward trend line in their societies? Things are getting better from a violence perspective, or better from, you had said, every real measure. If it's the case of both of these, then why would the Christian make that argument? If it's the case that the downward trend line is happening in places where there is basically religion of some type, maybe you just say religion has a dampening effect on violence.
I guess my irritation with it is that I feel like the overarching kind of American evangelical Christian perspective is that society and the world is getting worse and worse and has been since the dawn of time. And I don't find that compelling at all.
So, and Skylar's point, I will support that one with a little trip through the Bible. So let's do another trip through the Bible here. This will be fast. The Bible in 60 seconds, graphed for violence. Right? and we'll call this violence, or maybe evil.
So, Scott, real quick, that verse from Genesis 6 is, "The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth," so not the worst, but great, "and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually."
Okay, so
it wasn't as bad as a group as it could have been, but each individual was about as bad as they could be.
Okay, all right. Well, and that when you add them all up, thanks to the sum function, we know what it looks like. So here's the spike that happens. There's this growth to that point, and then you'll notice a rapid drop-off, and that one you have to correlate with population decline. And so basically the question is, did we do this, or once we zoom in, is it trending down over time? Now, when you consider, you know, the ancient Greek culture, if you read the Odyssey and you read the Iliad, you'll see that they are basically poetic descriptions of violence. It's just account of violence after violence after violence after violence after violence. And this guy took this rock, and it doesn't sound, you know, when you make a movie out of it, it's a lot more romantic. But it's, you know, Achilles. I'm trying to figure out who the first guy that did it, but they describe Hector and Ajax frequently picking up a big rock and throwing it and hitting somebody in the head. That particular one shows up several times, but it's basically just descriptions of violence. So, you know, did the world kind of do this up to some point? And as Rome comes in, they bring order. And when there's order, does the kind of barbaric inter-tribe violence die down? So does it kind of do this? And then, you know, at the height of Rome, you have the Pax Romana and those kinds of things. And then I think it would be hard to make a case in my mind of where do the cycles of violence increase or decrease significantly per capita? I would say that when I have looked at this in the past, not rigorously, but I've pulled some data, and what it actually looks like to me is that if you drew a correlation line over time, the line is actually pretty flat. Pretty flat when you talk about the whole world. If it's not flat, the downward trend line is not as sloped as it is here. It's a little bit closer to a zero slope. So if it is getting better, it's getting better very, very gradually. And if it's getting worse, you might say it's getting worse very, very gradually. But the problem is you have to draw that over time. Yes, sir?
You have to also take into account the what the world is doing as a whole in terms of like where it moves and how it ramps, and then also the sophistication of the endeavors of those you would consider human as well.
Yeah, and so technological sophistication helps a lot. You know, you add 8 feet onto a spear, and next thing you know, you defeat Persia, and add cavalry and a technique in there. You invent an atomic bomb, and you can destroy an entire city with one drop. So there are some idea, or you invent the airplane, and you can do lots of destruction in a short period of time.
Well, see, it's not even just destruction, but how effective that destruction is at convincing people that they ought to submit.
Right, right. That's a good point. So, yes, sir. Oh, sorry. Yes, ma'am.
I just feel like you're equating violence and evil, and those aren't.
Yeah. So that was going to be my next point, which is this is only one measure. This is only one measure. Is violence and evil the same thing? So let's pick one of these places wherever you think that it would be, and let's talk about where Paul was writing his epistles. So when Paul's writing the epistles, he's talking. Remember, the ratio of Christianity to the rest of the world was not this wedge that you see up here. It was, you know, this much to this much. And even Judaism could be said to be minimally influential from a numbers perspective. When Paul says things like the rest of the world, if the New Testament sounds like it's saying the rest of the world is going to you-know-where in a handbasket, it very much could have been the case that that's exactly the way that anybody would have described it at the time. So, to the Jew in Palestine, he's occupied. The Maccabean revolt's been put down. Shortly after Paul's writing, you have some terrible things happen. Nero's on the ascendancy. You have a whole line maybe of 5 emperors in a row. 3 of them were so bad that they would go down in history as absolute despots and tyrants, you know, in a relatively short period of time. From a previous run of senators and emperors who you can criticize a lot of what they wanted to do, but history will at least balance whether they think they were good or bad kind of guys. But that's not the case with, you know, the whole litany of guys that were running at that time. So it does look like, and Paul would be right to describe in his letters, a world where things are absolutely headed downhill fast. Now the question is, does Paul, we read those documents as timeless documents. If it was true at the time, then it's true now. And what I mean is, I don't mean that the ultimate truths are true. Any truth that is true at the time is true forever. But is Paul's description of the world is this way, or is heading this way, meant to be running 2,000 years into the future or not? And I think you'd have to, the burden is on somebody to say this, which was describing a temporal event, you know, and he's giving advice to fathers about giving their daughters away in marriage. He's giving advice to married people who are living separately for religious reasons. He's giving advice to people considering getting married. And what he says is, because of the way things are right now, it is better not to be married. Now, what does he mean by that? Does he mean from then until forever? Because parts of the monastic orders have interpreted things that way. Does he mean, hey, right now we are in this race run of emperors that are going to be horrific to Christians, they're going to light Christians on fire for torches and this kind of stuff? Does he mean during that period of time? Some people, I think a lot of people think that Paul expected the second coming of Christ to be imminent, as in, hey, don't bother buying a watch because by the time the battery runs out, you're not going to need it. It wasn't that kind of, was it that kind of feeling to Paul? I admit I don't read the New Testament that way. I think Paul's talking about there's this period of time, and Jesus had said, I could come back anytime. So I don't, if Paul, knowing Jesus' teachings as well as he did, probably would not have said, well, you know, my watch says this, unless he knew something very specific.
Yeah, I agree with Skylar that I think the world is getting better, and I think the slope is, but maybe I've got a little bit of perspective that many of you don't, but I'm almost 80, and I remember World War II, so I've been around when there has been some bad shit going on.
Yeah, right.
But overall, I'm also biased by what this time. I mean, this time we're in, if you leave ISIS out of it, things are pretty good. But what I want to know is, you say you have data to show that slope is flat. Where did you get that data?
Well, I'll pick up Julia's point on this one, which is it depends on what measure you want to use. So violent crime is a measure that people try to track very closely right now because we as a government are funding that kind of effort to say, let's track it and try to correct it. So,
did you say earlier that from the time of Noah that this slope is pretty flat?
What I'm saying is, Mike Minter gave a, and then I'll hit you, Brent. Mike Minter gave a has a sermon that he gives, I will say occasionally, or he has a variation of it he gives occasionally, where he basically says the world is getting worse. And I rewrote his sermon at his request, not that he gave it, but like he said, give me your feedback on it. And I basically made the argument and cited some studies that suggested that the world is bad and staying that way. And when you say bad, what you mean to, what we really mean to say is the world contains evil. And the kinds of evil that we want to scratch our head and say, how did this happen? Or how does this happen in our community? I mean, when you see the, some of the things that are on the newspaper front, it even happened in Loudoun or in Fairfax or in wherever you live, and you want to say to yourself, good grief, how does this happen right where in the place where we live? Or, you know, of course, you hear mass shooting stories or particularly horrific things that happen, and we're aghast that still within humanity remains this ability to do evil that we find incomprehensible. And we find it incomprehensible in that not only do we think that it's really bad, we in some ways have a difficulty imagining how we ourselves would have gotten to that point. So what we're really saying is in a society where we don't feel like we would ever even have a desire to do that, there are people in our society that clearly do because they do these horrible things. How did that turn out to be the case? What's wrong? What do we need to fix about our society is usually the way that we think of it in order to make this straight. Now, what the Christian will tell you is, I think, ought to tell you, I won't prescribe. I would say this is how I would like to answer that question. I would say you will never, ever get a society where you can completely contain evil from a top-down approach. And this isn't some argument for democracy or capitalism or anything else. This is a kingdom argument. The problem is not society. The problem with society is that it is a group of people and that those people have individual wrongs that they want to do. So if you want to fix society, it's terrible in that the job is this broad, but you have to fix every single heart in society if you want it to be truly good. And the only proposal to do that, if you actually look at it, and I'll step for 1 second and then rapidly back out into politics, there's only one political solution to all of this. There's only one system in the world, to my knowledge, that says the only way to fix this is to get every single person to have a heart towards God, towards love, towards these kinds of things, and it is a Judeo-Christian world. It will not work until this happens. You can't engineer it from the top down. It has to go completely bottom up, universally.
You see, generally, you see cycles of evil, right?
Yes.
You said, well, we have these problems with people who, you know, it's like, oh, we couldn't imagine people being like that. Well, they lived through, you know, terrible abuses, and, you know, even with some of the gang violence, they talk about you want to see the worst, cruelest group of human beings in the world, look at really young men, like adolescent men, who have no honor code taught to them by no, you know. So you have all these things where people are going through all these experiences, but you're right, like the only way of the cycles of evil are broken, which is why I tend to think that there's a slight up curve, the only way I've ever seen it happen is by some intervention.
Right.
And because the cycles continue themselves, maybe in different forms, but, and to your point, even like with the technology, you're like, well, yeah, you go to Brazil and you can go to a motel and you rent it by the hour and everybody knows why. But here, there's pornography. And so, you know, is the evil less, you know, is the whole system less evil? I don't know, maybe in the way that it appears. But, and especially here in America, where everything is hidden and hush-hush, and it's quiet and private and whatever, but in other cultures that where there's not so much money, really, that those things are very out in the open.
So let me, this is a good point. Let me throw it into these other three real quick, and then I'll make a provocative statement, hopefully, afterward.
So, in terms of whether or not the trend line is changing, I feel like it depends on exactly how you scope things in geography or time. You know, for instance, if you were to look at the life expectancy of young black men in America's inner cities, that's pretty terrible right now and hasn't always been that way. And in terms of time, you know, if you look at today versus the Assyrians, where they would go in and say, if you don't submit now, we're going to kill every last one of you, that seems like things are better.
Right.
And then you look 2,000 years before that at the Indus Valley civilization, an enormous civilization where there are no city walls found. They hadn't, and that we didn't see that in the Western world. So there were periods of extreme peace, and similarly with perhaps, say, the issue of women's rights, you know, 200 years ago, 300 years ago, women couldn't ride bicycles. You go back to the Minoan civilization, and women had incredibly advanced political rights. So I think if you scope it out over time, that line does flatten out, like they're saying.
Thank you for the argumentative support on that one. I will use that in a second.
Leaving aside the point of whether pornography or running motel rooms by the hour is evil, I mean, that's...
You
keep referring to authorities.
Yeah.
If there's no God, everything is permitted, right?
Yeah, you're right. We're not citing any of the... one of the reasons I'm not terribly concerned with citing the research on it is the point I'm about to make after... Did you have something you... Oh, yes, sir. Sorry, go ahead. Hold on 1 second, Dennis, and I'll answer why.
Like, is there a difference between evil thought versus evil action? And actually, going back to the verse that he read, was that, okay, individually we all have it inside of us. But what it almost seems like is like in all those times when, say, we thought that evil was occurring at a higher rate, that social accountability said that that was what was needed.
Right.
Or that, like, say, inner city, like, that was what's expected of them. Like, you create a group, and your personal social accountability says that's okay.
So I'm going to take a brief... this point is so important, I'm actually going to do a 90-degree right turn and talk about this for a second, and then come back to the major discussion. Mostly because I've been dealing with someone in my life right now who's asked exactly the same question, and I think had come up with the wrong idea. So
this is good, Scott, but when you're done with this, we need to discuss what evil is, right? Because... Dennis has decided that things are and are not evil, and we have to figure out how to define that.
Is this, we'll do. Yeah. Is this true? Are those all the same thing? If it's an evil thought, whatever evil is.
No. I'd put temptation before thought, actually.
Okay, so it depends on, okay, where it comes from, isn't the temptation may cause the thought? Yeah. Okay, but we think they're not equal. We do think they are equal. Okay.
No, acting on something is very different. If I told my wife I loved her but treated her like garbage, my thought of loving her is meaningless.
In support of Skylar's point of maybe things are trending upwards, one thing to consider is this. We might have gotten, and maybe you can say the opposite depending on what culture you're talking about, but we might have gotten more particular about what we think is right and wrong. So it used to be, I'll use an extreme example here of, you know, it used to say that guy did something in the 50s or the 30s. We'll say the 30s. You watch a movie in the 30s, one guy says something to the other guy, and the other guy doesn't like it. What does he do?
He
just decks him, right? And knocks him out. That's like seems to be what happens in these movies. Nowadays, if you say something that might be bad to somebody else without supplying a trigger warning ahead of time, then you have done something offensive to them. Now, regardless of what you think of those two things, if you want to make Skyler's point of things are going up, you might say, look at how bad it was in the 30s, where punching somebody was socially acceptable. Now, if anything, we have said it might not be socially acceptable to say something that might make somebody feel badly. So it may be that we're trying to fine-tune what we think is good and bad. Now, I believe I can probably come up with as easily as an opposite point, which is I would like to say that our thoughts towards abortion are new and bad and different, and that we've become more indifferent as a result. But if you actually go back and look at the original Hippocratic Oath has an injunction against giving a medicine to induce abortion. So this idea of doing evil, killing babies, has been around for a very long time. It may just be a result of technology is why we're better at doing it now than we have been before, and that the number of people who are engaging in it is increased as a result. But at any rate, I want to go back to this point. I want to call this one out because I think it's very important, and then I want to go back and I'll give you my provocative statement afterwards. Having an evil thought may simply be the result of having a creative mind and living in a society where the evil thought has some genesis outside yourself. But even if it has it out inside yourself, I don't think that's temptation. I'll tell you why I don't think that's temptation is, if it hits you without you even having thinking about it, you walk down the hall, or a good grief, you can drive around in your car today and see something that is arguably indecent and possibly evil that just hits you on a billboard. Is that a temptation? Now, what I will say temptation is not observation. So evil thought is an observation. It's an observation from your own mind. It's two ideas coming together in your mind or more. Or it's a visual, oral, or tactile stimulation that causes some sort of thought in your mind. Temptation is the cognitive consideration. It's the forebrain saying, perhaps I ought to participate in this further. That's temptation. That's not the doing of evil. That's the consideration of evil, or that's where temptation is. Maybe there's another thing you would put in here. But evil is the execution of it. Now, as Jesus taught, that execution can be actual, or that execution can be, I would like to think about it as though I were doing it. So if one looks at a woman lustfully, where the idea is they continue to think about them in a sexual way, or they think about them in a sexual way for the idea of their own pleasure, outside of the bonds of what they should do by prescription, then that is just as bad as doing the thing itself. And what Christ's point there is not that maybe they would have the same penalty. That is to say, would you say that it was equal if for your husband or your wife, Jesus said they're exactly the same. Would you rather that she, thought for a minute about doing the wrong thing, or would you rather that she actually went to the Brazilian hotel room and did the wrong thing? Do you have a preference if she was going to do one of them? Most people would prefer the one to the other. But so it wasn't that Jesus was saying, I think, that they are exactly the same. But the point is this, to the condition of the heart, to the exercise of will that says, I want to do either right or wrong. If you take it as binary, there is only right or wrong, then doing wrong in one direction, it's basically, to get scientific on it again, if, here's the line and there's right and wrong, the only difference between wrong and how wrong is not the direction of the vector, it's the magnitude of the vector. So I think what he's saying is it's in the wrong direction in any case, and therefore the opposite of what you should be doing.
And he says that too with divorce. Like he said, the actual term for the legal divorce is actual physical adultery.
Right.
Right. So you can't divorce your husband or wife because they, think about something.
Right. And I think most people skip the second verse. Second part of those verses, which is, we dwell on that side, but remember, does anybody remember what the next verses talk about? What, immediately following this one, if you look at a woman lustfully, I tell you, you have committed adultery in your heart. Almost, that's in another one close by. The next one is basically shortening it to a sentence. Anybody who becomes angry with their brother is guilty of murder. Now, on the one side, if you're a husband or your wife and you realize that your husband or wife has been having these thoughts or temptations and beyond temptation, but actually lusting, and you say, you know what, I'm going to divorce you as a result. If that's the case, and you're going to use that verse as the standard for why, you have to be careful, because if you've ever gotten angry at them, then you should be locked up in jail or committed to an institution. So if you're not equally willing to do that to yourself, then you ought to be careful about laying that standard out on somebody else. This is the equal rule anti-hypocrisy thing. Okay, Dennis, and then back to the major point. But I appreciate whoever brought up that point. This is a very, very important thing. The bottom line is, Christians, do not be worried when these things come and think that you have done wrong. The question is, do you move to here and stop doing that?
There's a great movie. I can't remember the name of it, but it's this happily married couple is on a cruise, and they run into this Robert Redford, who's very rich, falls for this wife.
Oh, right, yeah.
Offers him $1 million to sleep with her. What was the name?
Indecent Proposal.
Staggeringly good movie, if you haven't seen it. But the deal they made, remember, you saw the movie? They go back to it. Is what she did evil?
So, my name is Alfredo Alderis.
Alfredo.
My wife, Lydia. First time here. Nice to meet y'all. Because it's our first time, I'm not sure if you guys have actually defined evil, and I think that that is absolutely essential if you want to have this conversation, because if you don't all agree on what evil is, then how can we discuss whether it's getting better or worse? So I would like to pose that question.
You're here.
What is evil?
So we have...
I would like to add to that. Is evil the same as sin?
So good question, and good point, and... This is I love this kind of incisiveness because it means that it means a great many things. In this class, yes, we have defined it, but it has been a long time. The way we've done it most recently is basically in our discussion of a moral argument, said things are objectively, there are objective morals in the world, and there are only objective morals if there is an objective moral rule giver or maker. So the authority that I keep referring to, Dennis, as you'll know from the moral argument, is basically if God says this is the way to do it, that is good. If he says this is the way not to do it, that is wrong. And then the definition of evil basically is down to what God says. Now, the Christian philosopher, theologian, frequently tries to argue that a Euthyphro dilemma of is it good because God says so, in which case it's subjective, or is it good because God is honoring a higher good, in which case God is not the ultimate. Which of those two is it from the Socratic discussion? That there's another one, which is God says this is the way to do it because it's in accordance with his own nature, which is all good and all loving and that kind of stuff. So in short, if you take that root, that foundation of the definition of good and evil, things are good because they are godly. And things are evil because they are ungodly. That is to say, things that are that honor or act like the nature of God, or maybe a better way to say it is things that God would do or would consider to be in accordance with his nature would be good. Things that are counter to his nature would be evil, and the entire world's moral choices will comprise one of those two options in some way or some form. Yeah, in that case, you would say it is certainly the case that sin is evil, but I think it's wise in our culture to break evil down and say that it has been used to mean multiple things. We often say things like this natural evil that occurs. So is a mudslide morally evil? Well, depends on how. There you would have to. I would slave evil to sin and say they are identical, but in that case, you're not allowed to use the word evil to mean mudslide.
Right.
Well, I mean, to Dennis's point, when we're talking about purpose, which was this was really the genesis of this discussion, or you're talking about evil, evil is a sociobiological adaptation. It is a way that the world that we have just evolved or whatever to be that is an outworking. The reason that we think things are good and evil is because they're good for the propagation of the species or they're not.
And listen, your definition of evil is either being godly or ungodly is pretty vague. I mean, that's not really a...
Sir, how would you define evil?
I don't know. I think it's a stupid word.
He can't do it because Dostoevsky said if God, yes, God doesn't exist, everything is permitted.
So is there no...
He's right.
Jump on in, Julia. What do you think? Wait, 1 second. Julia's got a quick... It's so rare that she does it. It's time to hear it. 1 second. Go ahead.
I just feel like we went to a great deal of trouble to define good as a very specific definition of love and loving. So it seems to me that evil would be anything opposite of that, like anything not loving.
Yeah, so in the same way that Christ says, when asked, what is the greatest commandment? He says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul. Love your neighbor as yourself. And then he goes a step further and says, in this are summed up all the law and the prophets, or on this hang all the law and the prophets, depending on which book you're talking about. And so if you can say something like, here are books, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Leviticus, that are just like rules and rules and rules and rules and rules, and then the prophets excoriating people for doing the wrong thing and encouraging people to do the right thing, he says you can take all of that and distill it down to love God and love your neighbor as yourself. Not more than yourself, interestingly, just as much as you love yourself. So it is interesting to say that if the ultimate nature of God is love, then when we say something like consistent with God's nature, what we really mean is things that are loving are good, things that are unloving are bad. So that's another what ought to be identity relationship if you're going to say love can be said to be the maximal and complete descriptor of all that is good. If that is true, then they're identical.
Okay, I wanted to ask, what was your name again?
Alfredo.
You asked my definition of evil. I said I didn't like the word. That's not a good answer. But to me, it's a moving thing. What is considered evil or wrong today? Was it evil or wrong back then, 30 years from now? But
it's not true.
So do you believe it's
the basic things are the same, right? I mean, you can't take somebody's life. You can't take their things.
Not a good thing.
Why is that not a good thing?
You can't, that nobody's, the idea that different cultures have been married to different people, you know, you maybe have two wives or maybe you have three wives in some culture, but the idea that a man and a woman would end up together is something that's universal across, you know, millennia.
Alfredo, re-ask your question to Dennis. He was in the middle of answering it too. This is a good point, but let's, what was your answer to Alfredo's question?
He wanted to know what I thought evil was, and my first answer was I didn't think it was a good word, and that's a shitty answer, excuse me. But to me, evil is, like I said, it just depends. And that's almost as vague as godly or ungodly. But to your point, you said love is the circle that defines good. Well, in that movie, did you see the movie?
Well, let's hope, but before the movie, let me to your own point, because you haven't answered Alfredo's question yet, which is, it depends. It depends upon what? At least for the Christian answer, it depends upon God. So the sentence is complete. What does it depend upon in your milieu?
I have no clue.
Okay, but
hold on. Let's go through the further extension of that. It depends in theory for other people, but it doesn't depend when it happens to you.
I didn't hear.
I'm saying it doesn't. It depends in theory when we're talking about other people and we're saying, well, maybe this is right, maybe this is wrong. When somebody steals from you, you're pretty sure it's wrong.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So there are some things that are just like your favorite. You know, torturing a 4-year-old girl for fun is not a good thing. It's just. But there's.
It's just an evolutionary preference, Dennis.
What?
Well, yeah. Well, hold on 1 second. Go ahead. Yes, sir.
So C.S. Lewis had a really great metaphor for that. Was people who are non-Christian, think of it like a ship. So non-Christian, you know, being evil would be running into other ships. So you think like, okay, as long as I stay away from doing harm to others or affecting my environment negatively, that would be evil. But I think the Christian way of looking at it is like, how am I functioning kind of on the inside? And kind of the Dostoevsky quote, like, it literally can't happen that anything is permitted, because even non-Christian, atheist, whatever, there are certain things you know that you won't survive if you do these things. And you just, there's no reason not to do them other than survival or whatever in that moment.
Good point. Thank you. Yep.
But is climbing the Himalayas a sin? Is it evil? Because you might not survive.
Because you might not survive that one either. Yeah. Good point. That's
a
good point.
I'd like to just quickly add something.
Hold on 1 second, and you, and then back over here. Sorry.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, people are born as a blank slate, right? And to some degree, what you're born with is the capacity to learn what it is that you don't know. So like in the where is I going with this?
Think, man.
That always helps, right?
I didn't think about it a little bit.
All right, no sweat. We'll come back to you. No sweat. Yes, sir.
I think we all know what evil is. I think no matter what religion you are, you have some kind of foundational knowledge of what evil is. You have something inside of you that tells you what evil is, and that's exactly what you were saying. Everybody knows no matter what culture, at a foundational level, what it is. And I think, as a Christian, that comes from God. In Romans 1:20, he says, for since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations and their foolish hearts were darkened. So I think we all have that, and we just find ways to deny it, but God has placed the knowledge of good and evil in our hearts, and I think that's where it comes from. So, but I'd be welcome to a different explanation of what evil is.
Can we get high for a minute?
It depends on what we mean.
We'll end it up with this one. All right, so God, and you know, there's always a question. Everybody has a question. Where does evil come from? This is what I think. This is what I believe. This is a theory that I'm on right now. God did not create evil. God is not evil. There is nothing about God that is evil. Nothing. God does not make evil happen in the heart of man. Man makes evil. When Eve took that apple from that tree, that destroyed the relationship between man and God at that point. And what man's subsequent progress has been doing, even from an atheistic point of view, which, by the way, I think is very, very, very close to identifying God. Truly. I truly believe that. I mean, they're exhausting all the avenues to erase God. Still, God is always here. You can't erase God.
But which God?
So I don't... I don't think that theory is controversial amongst Christians. I think that that's orthodoxy. I think we would say, absolutely right. I would affirm that and say, sure, we know that God does not do evil. In fact, we can cite several scriptures that say that, and that there are some scriptures that say whence evil. But the idea is, if free will, by creating free will, period, then if God says, and having a command, so if God says, I'm going to create something with, yeah, go ahead.
Right, free will. When I first started doing this class a couple of years ago, I made a statement, and Dennis made a comment that now we're getting somewhere, now we're talking something like that. My statement was, God doesn't have free will. God doesn't need free will. God is out there. God is continuous. There is nothing about God that has to change. I believe it's just something that is totally, completely unnecessary.
So we'll talk about this in great detail when we talk on the Trinity, when we're talking about God. So we will get to that.
But that's
what Tenet is. Future spoiler. The latter half of what you said, I believe, is true. The former half, I would disagree with, but it's hard to do. It's hard to talk about. We will talk about it in some detail. Dennis, and then Kevin.
Alfredo, you define evil as something out of Romans.
Well, it's the same verse that
It was essentially. Let me internally know what.
Okay, but who wrote Romans?
Paul.
He was just a guy.
Yeah, that's right.
So let's define it this way.
Muhammad was just a guy, and he writes other stuff.
Even Muslims know what equals.
So L. Ron Hubbard is just a guy, and he writes other stuff.
Jesus basically.
Yeah, but so back to your point then, Dennis, on authority. The reason the Christian believes that Romans 1 is an apt description of why, of where evil comes from, or what evil is, or why man is without excuse for doing evil, isn't because Paul was a terrific writer. The belief there has to be that Paul was divinely inspired to do this, so that these are not simply Paul's words, they're also God's words. And so that's the reason he cites it. It's not because Paul, or because Muhammad, or because L. Ron Hubbard. It's because God. So all of this goes back to an authority, as you know, where God is the one making the moral proscriptions and prescriptions.
Yeah, but all these different guys think they're divinely inspired.
Yeah, the question is who's correct. You know, that may be the case that there are five scientists, five people who are endeavored in it. One of them is an evolutionary biologist. One of them is an intelligent designer. The other one's a young earth creationist. All of them think they're doing science. Which one's right?
Which one?
Which? Evolutionary biologist, intelligent design scientist, and young earth creationist. All of them believe they're doing science and they're getting the right answer. Which one of them is right?
Well, the evolutionary biologist relates to us.
Okay, well, now, let's say that that's the case in your viewpoint. To the Christian, the same is true of the other way. The bottom line is you can't say, just because there are three people saying it, they're equally likely to be right.
No, I didn't say they're likely to be right. I just said that's what they thought, and they got a lot of people to believe it.
Right, but the question is are a couple of them wrong and one of them right?
So let's go back to...
Well, I want to hear the answer to this question.
As far as science goes, you can prove that the last two are just baloney.
And I think as far as religion goes, you can prove the other way as well. And that's what we spent the last 6 weeks doing. So the reason for all those arguments is to say, of all the gods out there, there is only one that fits all of these scientific and philosophically rigorous arguments.
When we're defining evil, we're talking about we're each like a sheep gone astray, each to his own way, right? So we can go down to, and to connect with what you were saying, that evil is acting apart from who God is, right? So you'd say that basically, Lewis quoted it this way, that Some people say to God, thy will be done, and others, God says to those people, fine, have it your way. And that's kind of a synopsis of Romans 1, 2. But you go in and you look at it and you go, really, basically at its root core is the heart of, I do what I want, or I don't understand sometimes, but I'm going to follow you, God. And that's really the basic definition of doing evil or not.
With your permission and interest of time, let me transfer back to something we were doing. But if it's still germane, then jump back in. Okay, let me say why, not contra Skyler, but actually against everything that we've been talking about. Let me tell you why I think this doesn't matter. It does not matter whether we're trending up or trending down. When I say it doesn't matter, I mean, of course it matters. It matters especially in your neighborhood. But what I mean is, to the question we've been asking, what was the genesis of this whole discussion? Why were we asking all of these questions? The reason we were asking all these questions was saying, does this world have evil in it? And if there's a God behind it, how come he's not building a world without evil in it? Why was he incapable of doing so? The answer that we gave was basically, he is capable of doing so, but if you're going to have free will and the purpose of this world, of the part of the world that you see right now, is to maximize the number of people that end up in that perfect world, that world without evil in it, then you have to have this phase necessarily. It is not optional. If you have those two things, if you have purpose is max number, or that's not right, max percentile of people with free will.
Well, we need free will.
Free will people. Max percent, right, exactly. If you're gonna, and if love is the highest ethic, you can't not have free will. But if this is the goal, if this is the purpose of what God set, and by the way, I'll leave it to you this way. You've got two options of the world. God just creates the people who would be, I'll put it to you a different way. You can have 10 kids. You're going to have 10 kids. Let's say you're going to make 10 kids. Right, okay. How about 5 kids? Is that better? No, still too many? We'll say 10 for the sake of argument. You're going to have 10 kids, and you got lots of help if you need it. But you're going to have 10 kids.
Take exception.
And you can, yeah. I'm not going to have that argument. Well, we'll have that argument in here someday. That'll be a good one. You have 10 now, don't you? Actually, yeah, that's right.
Now. We're done.
Yeah, okay. Just, hey, you never know. You got to make it. That's what Bob Schull said at 4. And he's got 9. So, at any rate, if you're going to have 10 kids, let's say that you could have them and you could see the future of them. And you say this, I could take all 10 in, but unfortunately, you know that just in the course of having kids, 3 of your kids were going to be bad, miserable, and sad. In fact, so sad, let's say that 2 of them would have committed suicide, and the other one, by the time that he or she died, would wish that they had. Would you rather, maybe we would say, we might all say, well, if I could just not have the, if I knew I could not have that kid, I would not have that kid because I don't want to make him sad. Maybe we would do that as parents. 1 second, I'll get you on that one. Then what you do is say, well, okay, if I'm only going to create the kids that are good, I'll have 4 kids. But then you say to yourself, what about kid 5, 6, and 7? If we actually end up living where all of them, or most of them, are a little bit unhappy for a while, as it turns out, by the time they turn 10 years old or 18, or let's say they have their rebellious teenage years, by the time everybody hits 25 or higher, everybody's come back, prodigal son, the whole 9 yards, and you can live in pure happiness with all 7 of your kids who were going to be good, or would you just say, I don't love these? You can see them in the future, right? They're like kids that you've had. They're like the kids that you have today. You can see them in the future, and you say, I don't want those 3 because I don't want to go through the pain of it. Does that make you a better parent or a worse parent? I would argue that the better parent is going to say, I'll take a little bit of pain on my part, and even I'm willing to give a little bit of pain to my good kids because they'll learn that they were good, and these other ones will become good, and now I have a better, bigger, better loving family. That's the cosmic scheme that I'm drawing for you. The cosmic scheme I'm drawing for you that is if God's going to do this right here, if God's going to do this right here, then that's what he has to do. You have to have an arena world, before you have utopia. It is necessary. If that is good, and God is good necessarily, then that is necessary that this world have an arena world. That is to say, if you saw a world, now here's the counterintuitive part. If you saw a world that was all good with no bad history, you know what it ought to tell you? A maximally great God is not at the back of it, or alternately, that this is a deterministic world and you don't actually have free will. Those would be the conclusions I would draw from that. Those would be the conclusions I would draw. And I've laid some of it out. Al disagrees. I may have to call on him to see why. But first to Brian, and then we'll see about that.
He's formed like he's got some...
There's something I kind of struggle with here, and it's in the initial definition of this world. It feels kind of like a Euthyphro dilemma to me.
Okay. Shoot.
Because if we're defining, I think I've heard it called before, like a well of souls that God could draw from, and we're defining that there's different characteristics of souls. They will either always respond to him in good, always respond in evil, or dependent on what they see. What defines those souls?
So that right there is the assumption that I'm not making. So that what last statement that you made is an axiom that I would say does not allow for free will. Because what you just said was what the person does is dependent on the environment in which they land.
Not exactly, because
okay.
I'm saying...
So restate it into exactly what you mean.
We have been talking about souls that are differentiated based on a characteristic.
Yes.
How will they live in this world? Like, seeing forward in the future, how will they live? Will they respond in goodness, or will they respond in evil? And we're saying we can characteristically define that soul. And what I'm asking is, does this well of souls exist outside of God's influence? So it sits next to and apart from God? Or is this well of souls defined by God? And if it is defined by him, then he is defining evil people.
Then he's defining evil?
Defining evil people. He is creating...
Creating evil people.
Specifically. Yes.
Yes. So note that this model that we just outlined is that some people are good. Some people are good, ultimately good, but it depends on the world in which they live. If we say it that way, as we pointed out, that's a deterministic world. That what it is that it's deterministic in the same way that an iPhone is deterministic. So you could say an iPhone in the presence of a voice that's speaking to it will do a certain set of things. In the presence of things that are not speaking to it, it will do other things. But it depends solely and completely on the programming of the phone and the stimulus that's provided to it. There's no free will in an iPhone. Siri, thankfully, doesn't have free will, because then I would be guilty of desire to murder. If there is a... What we're saying here is that these are truly not indeterminate, but free. And what we mean by indeterminate may just mean we don't know. Free means that they can literally do either one as they themselves decide to do. And if you're not comfortable with the idea of free will there, let me at least put it this way, and this doesn't help. Sean's point has to be answered in order for this to make maximal sense. But ultimately, I've gone on record in the past as saying this. If you want to know what I believe the image of God is on man, it's this. We are as free as Almighty God is. We are as free as Almighty God is. The difference between us and God isn't in the valence of our will, isn't in how much we can choose to do something else. It's in power, right? We may desire to destroy the world, we cannot. We may desire to create things, we cannot. We may desire to kill everybody, but we can't. We may desire to help and create people, but we can't. Our power is bounded, but our will is not. And if you don't think that that's the case, ask yourself the question of why do you frequently will things that you know for a fact you don't have power to do? If I had a nickel for every time I wished I could fly by thinking about it, I would retire today. But I can't do that. But yet I still wish for it. So why do I wish for it? Why would I will it? The bottom line is my will greatly exceeds my own power and capability. But if free will is to be truly free, you have to be as free as God is. So maybe if you want to say, well, I don't, you know, there are limits on what that is, fine, place your logical limits on it. But the bottom line is, for this world, it doesn't matter, because this person is as free as God. That's the maybe somebody with free will isn't entirely free, but they're at least as free as God is. And if God's the one making the rules, if he's the authority, he's the one setting up it. And since this world is only judged based on the interplay with God, the bottom line is you're as free as God is in that world. That would be my best answer to you. I'm kind of going Gödel's incompleteness theorem on it and saying at this point, I won't argue against it, but let's just consider it as a system whose axioms cannot be proven by the system, and the axiom that I'm going to take on that one is make free will whatever you want, but all the free will creatures in them are equally valent in their free will. Okay, Dennis.
My last point, the end of the light note, is my favorite dude in your Bible is Noah. First thing he does after a year and a half on that stinking boat is get drunk.
Not the first thing. He must have made a tent in the first place, but yes.
Well, first thing he speaks.
Yes, right. Okay. Thank you for the comic relief, Dennis. Yes. So thank you, Skylar. That's where I was going. Huzzah. All right. Why does none of it matter? None of it matters because the purpose of the world that we're talking about here is to eradicate evil, not to dampen it or to make it less. So the problem, now I got it. Hold on. So I'll go where Skylar's going to go on this one, which is how else are you going to get to zero unless you trend line down, right?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. The problem is whether you believe in this case zero evil is a limit or whether it's an actual achievable thing. So I don't want to get, so I don't believe it's, I won't say it's a limit in this world, but let me point to maybe Kevin's point. I can't remember who brought it up. As long as there are cycles of evil. So the problem is, even if you dampen this thing down, the second that one guy or gal decides to get provocative at the end of it, it might kind of all fall apart again, or at least this little circle starts, and then more cycles of violence happen. Now the question is whether this dampening effect occurs continually or whether it's repetitive. What is it that causes the cycle to start in the first place? Yes, sir, go ahead, before you explode.
Yes. The premise, even the words that you're using, like, we're dampening this, like, there's this much chaos and we're just going to dampen it.
Yeah.
No, you're talking about putting in place systems and institutions to change the world and change society. There's a reason that we have democratically elected government. You know, these things develop over time. They are seen to work across societies, so they become the norms. The United Nations goes in place for a lot of obvious reasons, you know, following World War II. You know, we have Holocaust Museum, downtown DC. You put that in place because we recognize evil in the world and we take steps to make the world better.
Yep.
That is not exclusively a Christian, it's not exclusively a Christian drive, but it is something that Christians should feel is important and should drive towards and strive towards making the world a better place. Not to, well, we're gonna try and dampen down the evil while I take care of my soul. And
well, what I mean to that is the stuff you're talking about is a dampening effort. That is something that's intended to dampen. Yeah, well, a dampening and reduction are the same, mathematically speaking.
We're going to get into volatility.
Yeah, right.
go ahead. So you don't think it matters that we make the world a better place?
Absolutely, I think it matters.
Okay.
But it matters because of the individual, not because of the nation. So it doesn't matter if America becomes better. What it matters is, are Americans becoming better? It doesn't matter whether the United Nations becomes a good and powerful force. It matters whether the people who are behind it are becoming good and better people and powerful
society
people.
Society is an end goal, right?
Society
what are we really
is
aspiring to. Well, aspiring to no evil.
I think what I'm intending to say is, well, yes, absolutely. I mean, the purpose, remember, I'm going back to my argument. This is all in the context of an argument of how do we, why do we think the world is the way that it is if there is a God behind it? The idea is, I don't think it's God's intent for this world to become, ultimately, refine itself to become good. I think it's God's intent for this world to continue. Let's pretend for a second that I'm correct in calling the trend line flat, or maybe slightly tipped or whatever else. But at the end of the day, it seems based on biblical prophecy, if you believe that is intended to be literal in many ways, in some ways, that there will be a time when the nations rise up and fight against God. Now, if you take Revelation, you know, literally. So if Revelation is, not literally, if you take Revelation's metaphor about real events that will happen, then if that's the case, then it's not that the world finally refines itself into utopia. It's that all the bad guys get on one side and there's a and the whole earth may be overturned in fire and destruction, and a new earth and a new heaven made. So the question is God's plan refinement, if you believe things that way? It's, he's already said that's not going to be the case. We're going to cut it off and do it. But the question, really, maybe the question you're asking is, can it be refined down to that? Well, I think that that's a possible path. I think God could have done it that way. But in the doing so, God would have had to use the process of kind of kingdom thinking and living, the ethic that he outlines as his law. What is the law of God? As Paul is very clear on it, it's the law of love. Is that this law of love becomes adapted not by force from the top, but by broad acceptance, complete unilateral acceptance, unanimous acceptance by all of the peoples at an individual level.
But Jesus, like all of your discussion about these kind of very high-minded philosophical concepts does not match up with the literal teachings of Jesus, which were feed the hungry, clothe the naked, visit the imprisoned. Like, these are very practical, real-world examples of actions to take that contribute to making a better society in this plane of existence. And the reason why we do that is to provide comfort to our fellow man with a long-term goal, with a long-term salvific, salvific goal. But it's in this society. Christians should have a goal of making this world more just. That should be our motivating drive, with the recognition that that has a not secondary benefit, but the aspect of salvation comes later. It's afterwards. And you should do those things regardless of the guarantee of salvation.
I agree with almost all of that, with one I'm going to make one small change that I think would bring our views in line. You basically said the purpose of the Christian doing it is to make a better world. So I'll talk about the immediate purpose of the Christian. The problem with the purpose of doing that is to make a better world is that it ignores the fact that we ain't going to get there in the next 60 years, right? Will you agree that we're not going to be a perfect world in 60 years?
Well, not if we don't get started.
Okay, yeah, right. How about this? How about next year, by 2018? Not going to get there by 2018. Okay, yeah, right. people will die between now and 2018. So the idea here is going to be that the goal of the Christian ought to be to live in the kingdom in such love that people from the outside say, I want to be a part of that. Whatever that is, I want to be a part of that, because it seems like the utopia that I seek. And when people look into the kingdom and they say, this is what we want to be, then it brings other people into the kingdom who are not already in the kingdom, right? Let's say these are not Christians or not Christians. They come into the kingdom, now there are more Christians, and eventually that will build a better world. But the goal is not to build a better world. The goal is that these people, who, by the way, will pass out of this life on this planet to other places, can eventually be put back in the ultimate kingdom. But I think because there's death, You can't do it with the goal of building society, because you'll leave behind too many people that would otherwise have made it to that utopia. Because of death, you have to do something to bring the people who will die into the ultimate utopia.
I think you're still taking a too individual view, individualistic view of this, that we should build, this is why we build institutions and societies that survive.
Yeah, survive
after we're gone, even in this plane.
I think I'll be happy to accept that and say it is the kingdom of God then that must be built.
So, right along this line, I feel like every time you say society, that's just missing it. Because, so Christ said to do all those things, right? We should do them, one, because he said it, and two, because hopefully we love those people as well.
Yes.
But he was saying that in Jerusalem, knowing what was going to happen to Jerusalem, knowing what was going to happen to the nation of the Jews. So all these systems, these things that he was setting up, he knew were going to be obliterated except for his kingdom. So these earthly things that you're talking about, say the United Nations, right, we know will not last. We know that they have only temporal component, it's only to the extent it affects an individual life that it matters at all.
All right, so we are out of time, and since this is a graph of Skylar's agitation over time, since it's reached a local maximum here, I'll terminate it right at this point. We can take a couple minutes at the beginning of next class. Now I've run over by 10 minutes. Apologies. Next time we start the Trinity thing, we can do another 10 minutes or so ahead of at the beginning of that if we would like to on this topic. This is a grapefruit for continued discussion. I encourage you to have this discussion as much as you want, either in comments on the Facebook page or on your own, as you wish. But solid grounds, goal isn't to answer every single question. It's to make an attempt at it, but we don't have time to answer every single question, so we can continue this in the future, or we can continue it offline as well. But at any rate, thank you for your time. If you can hang around and help break down the class for the next church.